Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Damage Report under lockdown today, Wednesday. Thus, guest JR Jackson. How's it going, JR?
Hey, we're starting to get on a roll, John. This has been two straight Wednesdays.
Is Emma Vigeland not merciful? Anyway, I don't know if anyone saw, but we got you. You're good. So we had a disagreement on the show yesterday, Emma and I, about Nancy Pelosi's comment.
Oh.
And so she had a tweet up where, like, because she agrees with Nancy Pelosi, she's like, well, and obviously this means that I support everything that she's ever done policy-wise. And so I'm giving her all this crap about how she's now, like, a founding member of the Yas Queen Club.
So, I would have given, like, 10 seconds worth of thought as to which side each of you would have ended up on.
Hmm.
Yeah, I think I would have guessed correctly.
What about with Cenk? Would you have guessed that he would like it?
Yes.
Yeah, I probably would have too.
Absolutely.
I would have thought Emma was on my side because I respect her. hey everybody, welcome to the show. Lots planned that we'll be talking about. Obviously the CDC, thus the title. Will there be elections? Who knows? We'll see. We've got some stuff on deregulation and one of the worst signs at a protest that I've seen in a long time. But before we jump into that, I want to give people just a little bit more time to join us in the chat. And obviously, like the stream if you haven't already. We get to 1,000, maybe you see a dog. JR and I, right before we went live, we were briefly talking about, and you know, this is something that I'm sure a lot of people have a version of. I miss being at the studio. Like, have you seen Edwin's photo, JR?
No.
So as we were, the final day when we were clearing out of the studio and we were taking everything we would need to do the remote shooting, Edwin took a photo, I probably won't be able to find it, of like the dark studio, just of the desk. And no one's there, it's all dark and empty, and it's just like this really sad photo. And I just miss so much of our routine of like going to the food trucks and talking a little and, you know, all that stuff. Yes. I do miss it.
We were talking about just, you know, because we're doing everything from home. And I'm not sure if to you the days feel quicker. Like when you don't leave one spot, but you're doing similar work, the day just goes by so much faster. I look up and it's 2:30. I'm like, oh, my God.
Yeah.
There's something about changing your surroundings that allows your work energy to change. Like people have said before, like, oh man, I have a den in the house and I'm gonna totally start working from home. I said, I don't care if I have got 7 rooms available. I cannot work from home because I'll just get into this feeling that nothing is changing. I need a shift. Yeah. You know? So yeah, going in is definitely a thing.
Yeah, I feel like the days are passing very quickly. I mean, part of it is that we are working. I feel honestly like we have more work that we have to do throughout the day. Yeah. And I have a hard time, like I want, you know, after all the work of the day or whatever, I want to do something like creative or whatever, but I have a hard time doing it because, as you say, it's like you feel like you're in the same thing every all the time. And it actually makes me wonder, like, I've thought for a long time that I would enjoy space travel or living on Mars or something like that.
Yeah.
But, like, you'd kind of be in your one room all the time. So,
rethinking.
Not a good idea. But anyway, who knows? Maybe in a month, maybe we'll have, you know, a skeleton crew back at the studio once testing is, easy. We could do some sort of like, you know, every 2-week rotation or something like that. I've seen some people speculate that could help to limit exposure. And if people can get tested on a recurring basis. Anyway, we'll see. We'll see.
Yeah. Still got to wait for testing. Like John, you have a morning show. You're there for the morning. Then we shift out. You're the hell out of there. And then we move the next set of few folks in for the next show, you know.
I mean, look, I've been pushing for me to walk off the set and straight out of the building for a long time. I just haven't quite gotten there yet. Anyway, okay. As much as I would love to just talk, because it is fun, and as we said, the days are all the same, except this talking to you makes it a little bit different. We should probably jump into the news. Everybody, continue to send in your super chats and comments. Oh, wait, hold on. I don't know if it was Craig or if it was Bart. But I want to show you the photo I was talking about.
You got it.
Right there. Yeah, it's just, well, the contrast on my monitor is not great. But you get the idea. It's just a dark studio and the desk. And, like, you remember sitting at that desk? Feels like it's been forever. Anyway, with that, let's do some news. News broke this morning that current employees at the CDC are pushing back at what they view as being muzzled by the White House with politics being put ahead of science, far ahead. Science, you can't even see it in the rearview mirror. But anyway, I want to give you details of some of what these CDC employees have said recently to CNN. In interviews, CDC officials say their agency's efforts to mount a coordinated response to the COVID-19 pandemic has been hamstrung by a White House whose decisions are driven by politics rather than science. Right off the bat, find it pretty easy to believe that's basically what we've seen. What I want is specifics, though, and we do have some of that. One current CDC official says, "We've been muzzled. What's tough is that if we would have acted earlier on what we knew and recommended, we would have saved lives and money." And so we know the stakes. We know that that is what it is, that the damage to the economy could have been lessened if we'd contained this early on. Certainly, tens of thousands of lives, conservatively, could have been saved if we had taken it seriously. And when I say take it seriously, I'm not setting up some sort of impossible bar where, like, on January 5th, Trump is, you know, driving trucks of masks and testing kits across the country. I mean, if in late March, if in the middle of April he was taking it seriously, some of the damage could have been limited. And it seems like the CDC agrees.
Well, there's – okay. So there's – these expectations that people expect for the leadership of our country to have when it comes to things of this nature. And the way that, as this is pointed out with the CDC, it's if it's a political approach to everything, you won't get any action. You'll only get reaction because politicians only want to make sure things are clear for them to look ahead. So in preventing things, that's what you have your team for that aren't politicians or aren't politically based people. But this guy has been transferring the system so much to have just a blind loyalist that they won't actually do any work to prevent things. They'll only do things to protect him after things happen. So it's a reactionary approach to governing, which doesn't work out. I've said it before when it comes to the gun issue. If we do things on gun control or put things in place that will end maybe the number of mass shootings we have, we won't see those mass shootings. So when people say, "Oh man, but there was a mass shooting today," I said, but precautions and things we put in place that maybe stopped a mass shooting you never saw happen.
Exactly.
You can't go and say, "Hey, so that mass shooting on April 17th, it never happened." Yeah, because it never happens. So you don't get a chance to talk about it. So if you actually have some actions towards stopping a pandemic before it gets to this level or even addressing it when no one knows it's happening because you're the president and you have an administration full of people that get highly classified information, if you take that information and do something with it, we'll never see it and therefore we'll never have anything to react to.
Yeah.
If there's no news, that's a good thing. But Donald Trump is not in the no news department.
Yeah, we have to be able to consider multiple potential timelines. The one that we're currently in that we're trying to understand. The one that we could have been in had doctors and scientists been taken seriously and had their advice been solved. And also what we could have had if nothing had been done, which is what some initially wanted. Yeah, I will repeat until my dying day, Trump's "what if we just let it wash over us" thing. That was his theory. Just let everyone get coronavirus, let a certain percentage of the American public die, and then see what happens. He had to be talked out of that. That was a path that he wanted to walk down. It seemed like he had been talked out of it, but it looks like to the extent that he can, he's putting us back on that path. Because when we have these sorts of conversations, we are not just criticizing past decisions. First of all, we've been doing it day by day for the entirety of this thing. But also, we are concerned about the efforts that are going to be undertaken or not going to be undertaken in the near future as well. If we're considering different potential timelines with different potential numbers dead, that's not just looking backward. That's also looking forward. And really just hoping that, you know, that the people who are protesting are a small minority. And I hope that even in the states that are prematurely reopening, that people are still, that it has been drilled into them, that they need to distance socially, that they need to wear masks and all of that. I really hope that as we speak in Florida and Georgia and Kentucky and all the Texas, all those states that have reopened, that as many people as possible are still doing that, because that is our only hope if the doctors are not going to be listened to by government.
Yeah.
Yeah, let me read one or two more messages from the CDC official. So one said, "If you look at our guidance documents online, they've been watered down a lot. The ones that were written in March say, go home and stay there, and they're very clear. And the ones now say, in consultation with state and local governors, do what they say. We normally give guidance, and then states take that guidance and turn it into policy." And I get the frustration, because they're supposed to be, like they say, providing guidance. Instead, they're just saying, "I just do whatever, you know, your governor says, and, you know, pray that you have a governor that takes it seriously and not a governor that is going to be running an election, you know, in a Republican primary or something and desperately needs Trump to be on their side, because then they're probably going to do whatever Trump wants rather than what they should do. And the thing is, one reason they're watering down these guidelines is we know what happens when they don't water them down. They don't get released. That's happened very recently. If it is a strong statement, if it goes against the message that the White House itself is putting out, then it's just going to be kept internal. And our only hope is that at some point bits of it will be leaked.
Yeah, I mean, and as you've seen, so you attack leakers, you attack whistleblowers, you attack scientists, you attack logic, you attack all these things to make sure that whenever the people who know what they're talking about, who may say something that doesn't match up with their political goals, that you can subvert that and make sure that people listen to you instead of it. It's, again, it's, if you want to make sure that people are only blindly following you, you have to discredit everyone else. And usually, if you're on the wrong side of history, the people you're discrediting are giving you straight facts. We've seen every time the things that make Trump the most upset is when someone gives facts straight up.
It's pretty mad at Pelosi too, though, to be fair.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it, "You must unlearn what you have learned." And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
We've been worried that Donald Trump, fearing that he might not be able to win later on this year, might start talking about voter fraud more, coming up with insane ideas of what would be examples of that, talking about potentially delaying or canceling the election, or messing with the ability of the federal government and state governments to set up an election where people could vote and not be exposed to coronavirus. And we are slowly walking down several of those roads. Here's a couple of tweets that the president sent out earlier today. Donald Trump, breaking. Michigan sends absentee ballots to 7.7 million people ahead of primaries and the general election. This was done illegally and without authorization by a rogue Secretary of State. I will ask to hold up funding to Michigan if they want to go down this voter fraud path. So we're going to return to a couple of those points in just a second, but understand that this is not just about Michigan. He also said, state of Nevada thinks that they can send out illegal vote-by-mail ballots, creating a great voter fraud scenario. Wait, is it great? You don't think it's great. Why would you write great? For the state in the U.S., they can't. If they do, I think I can hold up funds to the state. Sorry, but you must not cheat in elections. So, JR, what he's saying there is, if you send out ballots to allow people to vote absentee or to vote by mail, that is inherently voter fraud, even though we should acknowledge that in the case of Michigan, he's not only a complete fraud, he also doesn't know what he's talking about. They did not send 7.7 million people ballots. They sent out applications so that they can apply, because the Secretary of State has a responsibility to make sure that people can vote even during a pandemic. But anyway, yeah. what do you think about this broadside against absentee ballots, mail-in ballots? It doesn't seem like a coincidence that he's talking about multiple states at the same time.
Yeah, we'll get to, I think, another story later about more of the dismantling of the parameters of our government when it comes to like our judicial system. But here, if you want to make sure you win more elections, you have to dismantle the voting system altogether if your party is not the popular party. the majority of the country doesn't agree with your party and sees your party as the problem. You have to find a way to eliminate those people. And this is age old. We know how this works. But it has to evolve with the times. And so now, under a wannabe dictator, you have to make sure you dismantle every aspect of it. So now voting by mail is now fraud. We already seen that happen. Registration for voting is also now fraud. It's ballots and not registration. You have to change the terminology of what is to something completely different just so you can say that voting, eventually we'll get to voting in America, is illegal. Voting in America is fraudulent. If you vote, you're actually not being very democratic. We're flipping reality on its head, and it sounds ridiculous, right? Think about the 27 to 50 other things that this guy has said that flip reality on its head, and we go, no one's really going to believe that, are they? And we move on, but then people believe it and glom onto it, and then that continues to get perpetuated to where now voting is a problem. In America, voting is not legal. It's not right. If you do it in the ways that it's always been done, then you're fraud.
I mean, you want a perfect example of that flipping reality? I mean, do you remember, what was it, 3 or 4 weeks ago? Press conference with Donald Trump, who's like, mail voting is a fraud. It shouldn't be allowed. Reporter, sir, didn't you vote by mail? Well, yeah, because I can.
Because that's me.
Well, straight up. Exactly.
So basically, the answer was because I did it, and I'm not there. So if I vote by mail, that's perfectly fine. Everyone else, you guys are criminals.
Yeah, 100%. And so while this is going on, understand he's attacking Michigan there and Nevada. When it comes to Michigan, the fact that he's saying you need to not do this, don't allow people to vote, or we'll take money away from you, I think that there's a very specific reason why he's making that particular threat today, and that is because Michigan is facing a significant threat from these dam failures. You might have seen news over the past day or two about that. Many people having to be evacuated. There is talk about, this is a quote from Governor Gretchen Whitmer, said in the next 12 to 15 hours, downtown Midland could be under approximately 9 feet of water. We are anticipating an historic high water level. And so obviously that's a significant problem. They're probably going to need help. Some of that help might need to come from the federal government. And oh, now is when he decides to put pressure to have them stop people from voting, when theoretically people's property, buildings, businesses, and even lives are at risk.
Kind of reminiscent of when he attacks anything else that happens with a disaster in a state to make sure that he says, hey, by the way, I'm going to cut something off or threatens to do so. With California wildfires, Puerto Rico, hurricanes. It continues to happen. If he doesn't like the people that are leading a certain state or territory, then you have to make sure that you threaten them when something natural happens to the area and to the people. So it's seen as an opportunity rather than a chance to actually help American people. So his position has become. It always has been an opportunity to propel himself at the expense of Americans.
Oh, you know what? Let's fit in a response, by the way, from he referenced the Secretary of State of Michigan. She tweeted in response to this saying, hi, I also have a name. It's Jocelyn Benson. And we sent applications, not ballots, just like my GOP colleagues in Iowa, Georgia, Nebraska, and West Virginia. And I am glad that she is doing the thankless and honestly pointless task of pointing out the lies and hypocrisy, just as we did with his vote. It doesn't matter. Like you pointed out, because it feels like, well, wouldn't you want to be consistent and factual? But they don't. He is okay with red states doing that. He's not okay with blue states doing that, purely based on who is likely to vote as a result of it. Especially Michigan is one of the key states that he desperately needs to win in the election. He wants, if he could have one person vote and have it be a Republican billionaire, he'd press the button on that plan in a second. He doesn't want people voting. It is an open, outright declared war on democracy. That's what it is. They're not having to hide it. They barely ever have, but they're certainly not now. They want fewer people to vote, and they will stop them with any means possible.
If you really think his support of those Michigan protesters, they're protesting lockdown guidelines, if you think that had anything to do with their freedoms and their desire to get back to work, you're losing your mind. He's like, oh, Michigan, that makes sense. Maybe that can help me. I see an opportunity here. Let me see if I can rile up people further and make them think that anyone who's on the opposite side of the aisle is against him. And it's for me, this will help my reelection chances. So everyone who's getting used by him on this, remember, he's encouraging you to jump out in the streets mm-hmm. and protest and do all this and tell these lies and push his narratives just so he can get reelected. It has nothing to do with you. And I don't know how many more times it can be said, because he's already discredited anyone who disagrees with him as just crazies or never Trumpers, even if they're Republicans, they must be hateful. All these things that are put together that you have to buy in order to continue to support him. I hope the number shrinks, but
yeah,
it appears to not.
And isn't it amazing? Like, you have 2% of the country that is sure that the greatest threat to liberties that's ever been created in the history of man is being asked politely to wear a mask before you shop at a nice grocery store. They're protesting about their rights being taken away by the fact that, you know, they're not allowed to willfully spread a fatal disease. While this has been going on, like, bills passed allowing Bill Barr to look at your search history without a warrant if he wants, among other, a variety of other privacy infringements that have been passed. The only legislative priority that Donald Trump and Mitch McConnell have right now when it comes to the coronavirus is taking away your ability to sue your employer if your employer sets up a dangerous environment and you get coronavirus and potentially someone around you dies as a result of it. They stripped you of that right. Like, your right to vote, hypothetically, in a democracy, which seems important. If you're going to uphold your rights in other areas, you kind of need to be able to choose representatives and things like that. They're getting rid of that. So there are actual threats to rights going on, but these people are not interested in any of that. They don't give a damn about it. They don't want to have to wear a mask. They want to be able to go to the gym. Or honestly not. A lot of the people in those crowds, I don't think that they're actively going to gyms. They just want to be mad and they want to feel like victims.
Yeah, or go to the hair salon and you see the way these folks look, you're like, trust. It hasn't only been a month or two since you've had your hair done. Sorry.
Okay, Pelosi. Jesus.
I'm hair shaming, not fat shaming.
That's true. I think that's still acceptable. And by the way, so this is a story that I know we're going to be talking about later on today, I believe, on the main show. But in terms of, again, the efforts that are undergoing to make sure that if we have an election in November, that it is not a substantive election. Just bear in mind, it's not just the mail voting, the absentee ballot, all of that. It's, you know, you got Georgia canceling election for a state Supreme Court seat, which apparently they believe he can legally do, canceled it, and now they hold that seat for 2 more years. He gets to appoint someone. He's an appoint a right-wing whack job, and for 2 more years, they're going to have that. And isn't it nice to have control, almost unilateral control? Brian Kemp, a guy who already interfered with the last election in Georgia, that he's now going to have an even more sympathetic state Supreme Court. So Georgia, a state that is looking like it might be tight in November, if he wants to, you know, strip away polling places or do other stuff, that gets challenged. Where does it go to? State Supreme Court.
Absolutely.
Which is his. It's a convenient setup if you can get it.
Yeah, we've seen how Mitch McConnell wants to make sure he controls the courts for generations to come. When he's long gone, he wants to make sure that his legacy of hatred and bias is sitting within America's courts, which will help destroy the country. It's the same thing. They know where the levers are to make sure that they're given free rein to do the things that they want to do. And, you know, there's just another level of it. It has to have coordination also with the retiring state Supreme Court justice in Georgia that said, hey, I'm going to resign and my end date is now before the end of the year to make sure that this part of the law can be put in a place to allow Governor Kemp to do this. It all has to be coordinated. It's not a coincidence. They know, we know, it's like there's too many coincidences where they get exactly what they want based off people that are in the same party.
Yeah.
Come on, man.
Mike Pompeo is not having a good couple days of news. The firing late last Friday of an IG that was apparently investigating him for multiple different reasons is sticking around, and it should, because every bit of this story stinks, including new developments that we will talk about today. First, this has to do with, we initially thought that the Inspector General, Steve Linnick, might have been fired as a result of investigating Mike Pompeo using an aide to run errands and things like that. Then it came out that he was also investigating the decision to declare an emergency to allow for arms sales to Saudi Arabia. We found out a little bit more about that particular investigation. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo apparently declined an interview request for the State Department Inspector General's inquiry into whether that was an illegal move to declare that emergency to bypass a congressional freeze on arms sales to Saudi Arabia and the UAE, according to three different people. Mike Pompeo instead chose to answer written questions from investigators working for the Inspector General. That indicates that the Secretary of State was aware of Mr. Linnick's investigation and the specific lines of questioning, something that he has previously denied, that he doesn't know about these investigations until they come out. Well, that's convenient. You already answered written questions about it, so you knew exactly what they were looking into. And between you doing that and the investigation being concluded, you pushed for the guy doing the investigation to be fired, which is, to a rational person, going to look incredibly suspicious.
So you just figure one day, you go, yeah, you know, I think I'm going to fire this guy based off of absolutely nothing. So let me just do it, and I have no knowledge of anything. And so when someone asks you, hey, so what about this investigation with the Saudi arms deal, you really think you can answer the question and think no one will see the evidence that you had previously rejected an interview with the same IG, but mm-hmm. then sent questions. I'm not, again, it's not even trying to avoid, being found out. Mm-hmm. They don't even care anymore. It's, let's just lie. And then after people find out that we're lying, we just won't say anything, no comment, and move on to the next lie, which is going to come in 2 to 3 hours later. I'm not sure if he's going to be held accountable to this every time then he steps in front of a podium. Someone should ask him, hey, so why'd you lie to us about not knowing about the investigation? Mm-hmm. Ask him straight up. Don't say, hey, what did you know about the investigation? Because he'll lie again. Say, why did you lie? Because it is a fact. We see it now. You've lied about it. Why did you lie? What are you trying to cover up? What's the problem?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, maybe he'll take cues from Trump and just refer to it as a nasty question. But yeah, it's a question that needs to be asked. And I agree with you that the odds of him facing real consequences seem low, especially because there's just so much of this going on that it's difficult to stay on it. Like, so we're talking about this now. We talked about it a couple days ago. I had missed that they also fired an inspector general in the transportation department that apparently was doing some investigations. That person got fired and got replaced by someone that Mitch McConnell, who is married to the head of the transportation department, has already vetted and is an individual now that at least on an interim basis is going to be running a sort of subsection of the department and will be the inspector general for that same department. So he is the person running it, and he's the person in charge of making sure that nothing illegal is being done when it's being run. And one of the investigations that was being conducted was whether Elaine Chao had used her control of the department to throw a bunch of money to Mitch McConnell's state to make him look good during a difficult election. It is so thoroughly corrupt from floor to ceiling.
Yeah.
And how do you track it all?
Yes. No, the thing is, you would think it was some level of complexity to the corruption. It's straightforward. It's not that Mitch McConnell has a wife that's ahead of this, and then there's a roundabout way that some surrogate or maybe her cousin owns this company and he funded it through her. And maybe we don't know this cousin's name because it's not a big name. We know these people's names, and it's directly going straight between the three big players. Mm-hmm. You know, you got Trump, you got McConnell, and you got his wife. And then anybody who's interfering with that gets kicked the hell out. Again, back to the Pompeo thing, they don't even care anymore about covering it up because, like, well, we got people sucked into it and brain melts, and we have other people of power that are going to undercut anything else. Look, Department of Justice has been put in place to continue to provide cover. He bought the cops. It's a mob scene, straight up.
So we have the AIDS stuff, we have the Saudi Arabia stuff. We had already, we talked about the last time, how he had had a number of, he took a number of seemingly needless trips to Kansas, I believe it was. And the idea being that he was pretending that it was official State Department business, but it wasn't. He was going out there to meet with potential donors and things like that to potentially set up some sort of political run or something like that. I don't know if that's true. But we do now know about a little bit more spending that he's been doing that seems to point in that direction. He apparently regularly held taxpayer-funded 500-guest formal dinners that President Trump supposedly knew nothing about. He held about 24 Madison dinners since he took office back in 2018, and they were scheduled through October until the coronavirus hit. Let me give you some details about this. So State Department officials involved in the dinner said they had raised concerns internally that the events were essentially using federal resources to cultivate a donor and supporter base for Pompeo's political ambitions, complete with extensive contact information that gets sent back to Susan Pompeo's personal email address. And if that seems like, well, I mean, come on, hypothetically, anytime you have a dinner, you'd be talking to people. Some of the guests include Laura Ingraham, Matt and Mercedes Schlapp. So these are huge Republican donors, funders, and all of that. They needed to be at this State Department dinner. And they get all the information. Chick-fil-A CEO Dan Cathy, who again is a major donor for Republican politicians. What is he involved in diplomacy with Lithuania? What's the chicken guy doing there? The chicken guy isn't needed for international diplomacy. And indeed, it appears that few people actually were, because just 14% of the guests at these events had anything whatsoever to do with foreign policy.
They're there for the political ambition. And again, we're paying for it. And we can keep complaining. I was just saying this the other day. We can keep complaining about how they're wasting our time and they want to keep us inside. They don't let us work. They don't care about you working. Not at all. There's nothing about you working that they care about. They care about you supporting them so they can get their asses back in office and continue to screw people over. So I don't know. I keep going back to supporters because I'm finding it increasingly hard to believe that they don't really see what's happening. It just becomes complacent agreement. It's like, yeah, I'm just going along with it because I'm not sure what you're getting from it. At least Laura Ingraham, when she lies every day on her show, she's getting invites to 500, how much plate dinners?
At least 500 people. 500 massive people. Harps playing. There are probably some ice sculptures and things like that. They get goodie bags to take away, like fancy pens and journals and things like that. You paid for that, JR, and I paid for that. I paid for the harp to play for these ghouls.
But people will complain about SNAP food programs. They'll complain about assistance for kids.
Oh, my God.
They'll complain about elderly assistance. They'll complain about any taxpayer money that goes to anything except for wars and reelecting politicians on the Republican side, using campaign dollars for that. I'm using taxpayer dollars for your campaign. They won't complain about that stuff. For some reason, everything else is just way too much to provide. Oh, healthcare? Oh, my God. How much we spend on healthcare? How much are we spending on things like this that they actually despise you? They're laughing. They sit their heads back at these things and do the rich man chuckle when they're holding their glass of whatever fancy drink like this. Just like this.
I don't even know. It's been a while since I watched Frasier. I don't know what fancy drink.
Oh, here it is. I have one.
Yeah?
You have to hold their glasses just like this.
Exactly. The point about SNAP is a great point, JR. That we're – I don't even know what fancy food they're eating. Something fancy. That's okay.
Except in my glass, anyway, all I got is lemonade. So, I mean, I don't have the fancy drink.
Yeah, I don't either. I have this is why I'm falling apart physically. I'm drinking Green Monsters in the morning, and I'm dying. Now let's tie this all together, because this last bit about the dinners and stuff isn't necessarily just another separate scandal. It might indeed be tied in with what we were talking about with the Inspector General. We don't know for sure. It's unclear whether the Inspector General was also investigating these Madison dinners, but two administration officials told NBC News that Linick made some type of inquiry to the protocol office last week before he was fired. One of the officials said Pompeo's office was then notified.
Mm.
I mean, we don't know, but come on, people.
Oh, my God. Hey,
it's about the walking the dog. That's what it was. It was about him having an aide walk a dog. It's not that he's worried that the incredibly expensive campaign dinners that we're paying for are going to finally be cut off and it's going to create a scandal that hypothetically could hurt his future political run. No, he would never let those considerations lead to an IG being fired. Why not? They're throwing them all overboard. Why not add one more to the pile at this point? I tweeted, in D.C. right now, if an inspector general looks you dead in the eye, they get fired. That's all it takes at this point is eye contact. And they set you on fire.
It's unprecedented. It's unprecedented. I'm not sure how much further it can go before people realize it's exactly what it looks like. You don't have to. These aren't. Okay. You can connect the dots on something like, when things get reported back to the wife of the guy who's misusing government funds to pursue his political career. You can't connect those dots, but you can somehow connect the dots on Obamagate when there's nothing. You can connect those dots. You can connect the dots on spraying Lysol in your face for coronavirus. You can connect the dots on taking hydroxychloroquine when the president's lying about doing that. And actually, maybe he is. But either way it goes, you can make all those things and assume that it's fine. But you don't think this is a reality.
Yeah.
It's willful.
Like I said before, I don't know what Obamagate is. And that is the thing I have most in common with Donald Trump. He doesn't know what it is either. but what I suspect it is if you are desperate to be able to pretend to care about government corruption, but you have an ideological reason that you have to ignore all of this abundant corruption going on, then it's convenient to have this other thing to talk about. Donald Trump is not really doing anything about the pandemic right now, but that doesn't mean that he's not doing anything. He's doing stuff with the pandemic as cover. Take a look at this video. It has to do with his new push to deregulate everything.
Because with millions of Americans forced out of work by the virus, it's more important than ever to remove burdens that destroy American jobs. In a few minutes, I will sign an executive order instructing federal agencies to use any and all authority to waive, suspend, and eliminate unnecessary regulations that impede economic recovery. And we want to leave it that way.
Okay, so what he's saying there is, I'm telling all of the federal government to look for any regulation that could conceivably be linked to hurting business, which we know one of the cores of conservative ideology is that every regulation hurts business, hurts profits, and all of that, and to get rid of it. They're saying it's about coronavirus, but they wanted to do this before, and he just said he wants it to be permanent. It has nothing to do with the pandemic.
Yep, it's again, more for opportunities. Like, oh man, you know, global pandemic's going on, and Americans are affected severely by it. Hey, here's our chance to start throwing things in there. And guess what they do? And guess what they usually do on these types of things? They accuse their opposing party of doing these things. Again, it's the same deflection. Hey, look over there. Look what they're doing while we stand right here and do it. It's pretty obvious. He's not even good at it. That's the way, like, straight up. Hey, I want to eliminate any and all regulations on all businesses because of the pandemic and then make it permanent after the pandemic. What are we talking about? So, again, putting that in any kind of real life terms is food safety, air quality, anything that the plants want to do that we've been trying to help keep them from doing to all this time, they'll just do. And then you can pay the price for it, I guess. I mean, people in the areas that he doesn't care about, who many of them are his voters, understand that he's putting these things on you. There's not going to be any pollutants. There's not going to be a lack of any kind of quality controls on anything that he puts in his body. Trust me. Mm-hmm. So that just falls to you. Same thing with this come back to work thing as early as possible. He's not going out and putting his face in front of everyone's face, and neither his supporters, and neither his like surrounding people. Just you guys, just the supporters are.
Yeah, and so we talked about a version of this earlier on. So two areas that we've talked about on the damage report about this. One is we've been talking constantly about the meatpacking plants and the deregulation that they pushed through that have not only obviously increases the risk of some sort of contamination getting out there, but it's amidst the pandemic when you should be even more careful about what's going on at these places, but also the EPA. So the EPA has already used the pandemic to suspend reporting rules and other requirements for the fossil fuel industry, which green groups warned gives oil companies a green light to pollute the nation's air and water with impunity, and they're doing that. This is just an expansion to everything. And the problem is, so there's bad news and there's good news. The bad news is that they're gonna find any excuse for all this stuff. It's gonna be incredibly broad. Some of it hypothetically is going to be permanent. The good news is that while he can do this, and a lot of this won't require the input in any way of the Senate or the House or anything like that, some of it could be challenged hypothetically to the Supreme Court. And with every passing day, good luck with the courts. But the good news is that a lot of this is just as easy to reverse, hypothetically. If you get him out of office, some of this could be reversed. Now, some of it perhaps in a Biden administration would not be. A lot of it, I think, would. The environmental changes, I have no doubt that the like reversal of Obama executive orders on the environment, that he would reverse them too. I doubt he'd go much further, but at least we'd have that. And as long as he's there, he's going to have the ability to do all of this. And every one of these, we try to remind people, every one of these regulations is a protection that has been put in place to tamp down on the excesses of industry and protect American lives. That's what it's, or the workers. The consumers are workers. That's what they're there for. That's what they're getting rid of. That's what the stakes are.
Good luck convincing folks of that, because for some reason that doesn't compute. I'm not sure when it's going to come through that way, but people just don't think of it that way. And so when you talk about the only way to maybe stop this is when someone else may come in, another president, and and cut out all these executive orders. But I mean, as we've been mentioning throughout this show, the other aspects of this whole plan put into place to make sure that doesn't happen. So dismantle the election system, dismantle democracy, and then also dismantle our protections like this so that there isn't much of a chance for someone else to come in and do these things. It's across the board coordinated effort to do this while also holding on to power.
Wait, hold on. So let me get you right. So are you saying that it might be difficult to convince a certain percentage of the American public that these very reasonable limitations on business are in their best interests, when that same percentage of the American public thinks that wearing a mask to protect them from disease is the gravest threat to American liberty since the founding of the Republic?
Yes.
Is that what you're saying?
Close. You're close.
You might be onto something. You might. Okay. So we're going to keep an eye on it. The issue is we're going to need a lot of good reporters watching a lot of agencies to even know what they're changing. Because, again, a lot of this can be done internally. It's not, they're not going to have one bill that's going to have all the regulation changes. There have been a lot of objectionable signs at some of these anti-lockdown protests around the country. Anti-Semitic, Confederate flags, Nazi swastikas, things like that. One has stood out that you might have seen gone viral the past few days, and it's this one. A woman holding a sign in Humboldt County, California, saying, "Muzzles are for dogs and slaves. I am a free human being." Mm. With a picture there of a slave. She has been found out and identified and has received a lot of negative pushback. Organizations that she'd been involved with have said that they have no ties with her or anything like that. Now, she does have a statement. I want to give you the statement, and then we'll respond. She said, "Holding that sign up at the lockdown protest was a grave mistake, and I ask forgiveness from all those who I have caused pain. As I had no sign of my own, it was handed to me by another protester, and a photographer took the picture before I considered the racist implications. My intent was to take a stand for the freedom of all human persons, and I mistakenly held a sign that conveyed the opposite. Please know that I respect the dignity of all people, and I sincerely regret any suffering it had caused." Thoughts?
Okay. You show up to a rally or an anti-quarantine or anti-stay-at-home rally, or whatever it is they're trying to protest, and you collect yourself around people who we've already, many outlets have already told you, there's hateful people, there's people that are there and have nothing, they're protesting things that have nothing to do with anti-lockdown procedures, but you'll just go in blindly. And you won't come prepared enough for one. You won't come with a sign prepared for a sign. And you'll take a sign from some random person that has 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 words on it, and you didn't take the 3.5 seconds to read it before you held it up and presented it to a photographer. You can see a little bit of the blame she's pushing towards the photographer. And a photographer took the picture before I considered the racist implications. Mm-hmm. So a photographer snuck a picture of you is what you're basically saying, before you had a chance to realize that you're holding a racist sign. Mm-hmm. Okay. My next question to you, random lady, Greta, are you going to go back? Do you still support these people? Do you still support people that are giving you racist signs? Or did you actually pick up the sign, read it, and go, "Oh, this is fun. This will really punch it home," and hold it up, and then after you found out, decide to say that you didn't have anything to do with it? Just one.
We'll have to see. Yeah, look, if I were this person, my argument would probably not be, "No, what happened was a person thrust it into my hands and instantaneously a photo was taken," because that seems a little bit unlikely. I would say, so here, let me bring up the sign. So what I was saying was, slaves were muzzled, and that's awful, and so we shouldn't do that. Now, that would be insane, because to compare wearing a mask for a limited period of time to save people's lives to being Muslim would be insane. But at least then you could argue that you were saying people shouldn't have been enslaved. This seems to take an oddly passive stance on human slavery, which is weird. I want to give you the facts, by the way, on who this individual that's being co-opted into this is. The sign featured an image of Escrava Anastasia, Anastasia the Enslaved, a female slave thought to be of African descent who lived in Brazil during the 19th century and is an unofficial saint in that country. She's always depicted in a face mask and collar. And that pair of sentences right there is more factual concern for the actual person being used than ever went into the creation or implementation of that sign. And the thing is, like, the individual isn't even the issue to me. This Greta, I'm never going to think about this person again in my life. But isn't it weird that at these protests that are supposedly about liberty and freedom, signs like this show up and they have swastikas and they say, no, I have the swastika because I'm saying that you're a Nazi. I'm not just desperate to hold a swastika sign. Or, like, in Ohio, it was confirmed that someone had a sign that had, like, a stereotypical image of a Jewish individual as a rat, and it says, the real problem. Why do these things keep popping up? Why is that? Seems weird, since it has nothing to do with racism or anti-Semitism or anything like that. It's just about liberties, that it seems to bring out all these people who really hate a lot of groups.
And you also wonder, so you glance at the sign, maybe I'm in the minority here. Your eyes are drawn to this image of this human head with a mask over it. And it's an old black and white photo. The first thing you think is, oh, who's this? What's this about? Not, hey, here's a sign with a face on it and several words. Let me just hold it up.
Yeah.
Nobody does that. Nobody does that. No. Come on, man.
Yeah, I'll get around to reading the words at some point. I don't got time. I got to pose for this photo.
Yeah. What are you holding up for if you don't want to be seen?
Let me bring back the actual image, because the way it's being held, that's not how you would hold that sign. That's how you present that sign to a photographer. And another woman did as well. It wasn't just her, and she says it wasn't her sign. Another woman was happily smiling into a camera with that sign. Again, this movement is not nearly as large as it wants you to believe, and I understand that by covering it, we make it seem bigger. I get that. That's why I try to acknowledge that it's not big, and we talk about the actual polls. But also, we should understand the nature of it. It's not to say that everybody thinks these things, but it is weird that people who do think these things find this movement so appealing. Maybe something to consider before going to one of these protests.
Maybe. If you want to think for a couple seconds before you do anything, but that's never been a hallmark of folks like this.
While we're all concerned about the pandemic, and rightfully so, we shouldn't become so focused on the experience of people exactly like us here inside of the United States that we forget that some communities are being hit much harder and are being hit in a way that isn't necessarily being focused on or reacted to. And so to help fill in some of those gaps, I'd like to welcome back to the show the executive director of We Exist Too, Ahmad Ibsace. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Glad to have you on. And, you know, I know that you've been doing a lot of writing recently about how the pandemic is affecting refugee populations. So can you tell us a little bit about some of the work that you've been doing?
Yeah, of course. So we don't see the extreme refugee crisis here in the United States. And there's not a big refugee population here, at least where I am. In Sarasota, Florida. So sometimes it's kind of hard for a lot of us to gauge what's happening on the other side of the world. So I've been trying to write and organize my own community to kind of recognize the refugee crisis, because there's so many people, over 70 million people suffering internationally and that are internally displaced within their own countries and communities that are not getting recognized by any country. So they're not getting any sort of health care, food, water, housing, any sort of infrastructure. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I've been wondering now for some time, some of these communities, whether it's like refugee communities, or I know, you know, the situation in Yemen, they've been absolutely devastated by disease already. Some of these areas, do we have any idea how much coronavirus there is there? Is there testing going on at all? If it's rampaging through these communities, would we even know?
Yeah, so that's the big issue with a lot of these communities being internally displaced as well as internationally displaced, is that they don't have their own kind of country or land that or government that's even giving them any sort of testing. So we don't know how big coronavirus is within these communities. And because of these communities have no access to healthcare and are put in such tight quarters, they're the perfect breeding ground for coronavirus and other sorts of infectious diseases and community diseases.
You know, in the lead up, the last couple of years, I know that Donald Trump has successfully cut the number of refugees that we resettle internally in the U.S. And I know that the European response to some of the refugees crossing the Mediterranean has been horrendous, better in some ways. And so there was already a lot of trouble with getting help to these people. With so many countries dealing with coronavirus internally, do you see much outreach either from the UN or from the EU? Is there any aid being offered to some of these communities during the pandemic?
Yeah, so the United Nations Refugee Agency, UNHCR, is doing their best, but they only receive half the aid that they actually need to provide any sort of relief to the refugees. But there's a lot of organizations like UMR, which is the United Mission for Resource and Development, which does a lot of work with Muslim refugees because approximately a little bit over 50% of refugees are Muslim refugees. So there's a lot of organizations doing on the grounds work, but not so much of a governmental work to help refugees.
Yeah. What do you have any suggestions on what you think? Is there anything that the U.S. government should be doing or that you'd like to see the U.N. do? Obviously, having more funding would be good. But what are some specific efforts that you'd like to see them engage in?
Well, of course, I'd first like to see like the United States and other Europeans just at least recognize the extent of the refugee crisis, because, like I said, there's 70 million people pretty much suffering without any access to relief, food, water, electricity, healthcare. So just first of all, recognizing and then educating our communities on what we can do individually to help, whether that's donating food packages or like this Sunday is going to be Eid, which is a Muslim celebration. And all of these Muslim children are not going to have any sort of celebration in their own right. Most of them won't have any food. So whether that's like toy drives or, like I said, food services, there's a lot of ways in which we can help individually and either send aid or give aid within our own community.
Are there any specific organizations that you've perhaps worked with in the past that you think have a good reputation or reputable that perhaps viewers of this video could provide some support to?
Yes. Like I said, UMR and also UNRWA, which is helping Palestinian refugees, especially during Ramadan, which is about to end.
Okay. And, you know, I'm curious, like looking forward, let's say, you know, we get past the pandemic, we get past potentially a second wave that comes. What do you think, looking forward over the next few years to the next like 5 years or so, do you think that some of the experience of the pandemic, especially the, you know, the xenophobia towards China, the concern over international travel, do you fear that that might sort of linger in people's minds, fear of bringing people in, having relatively open borders, that might hinder efforts to provide more assistance to refugees in the future?
Yeah, so this refugee crisis has pretty much been ongoing for decades, and the xenophobia in America has also been ongoing for centuries. So this like you said, xenophobic issues and issues with immigration is going to exist long after coronavirus. But I think as like global citizens, we need to recognize that it's our duty to help the most vulnerable. And just like I said, educate our communities to see that these people are suffering kind of the worst human conditions that any of us will experience. And that it's our duty to kind of give aid where we're able to.
100%.
Because we are coming from a place of privilege.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. I try to tell people all the time, like I'm even inside of the United States case, the fact that I'm one of the lucky few who's able to work from home, like, I try to bear that in mind. And so I want to thank you for coming on. I know that everybody's dealing with stuff here, but I don't want them to forget that there are other communities that have it much worse and that already had it really bad before the pandemic added on to these problems. So, Ahmad, as always, we appreciate you joining us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Have a good day.
You too. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.